This morning, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued part of its 2021 report, its latest on Earth's rapidly changing climate. All five earlier assessment reports warned that modern human activity is transforming global environmental systems. But scientists often speak carefully in public, and the politics of climate change is tricky, so those previous warnings sounded almost bland. Not today.
You've been telling us for over three decades of the dangers of allowing the planet to warm. The world listened, but didn't hear. The world listened, but it didn't act strongly enough. And as a result, climate change is a problem that is here now. Nobody is safe, and it's getting worse faster.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and that was Inger Andersen, the executive director of the UN Environment Program, at a press conference this morning. The IPCC is made up of scientists representing more than 190 nations, and today, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called the report, quote, code red for humanity. Well, Beverly Law is professor emeritus at Oregon State University's Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society. She's been a reviewer for three IPCC reports, and she joins us now from Corvallis, Oregon. Professor Law, welcome. And let me first ask you, is this a code red for humanity?
Hello, Meghna. Yes, unfortunately. We lose a lot of sleep over this.
Well, also with us today from Williamstown, Massachusetts, is William Mumaw, Professor Emeritus of International Environmental Policy at Tufts University and visiting scientist at the Woodwell Climate Research Center, also lead author of several past IPCC reports. Professor Mumaw, welcome to you as well. And similar question, what is it specifically about this latest report from the IPCC that makes it a code red moment?
I think that for the first time, there is just no equivocation that human activities, and they are specified in this report, that those activities have caused the changes that we are seeing and that we have to act very quickly to abate them. And we will have some of these with us, not just for years, but for centuries and maybe millennia.
Okay, so tell me a little bit more about what the specific impacts that the report, today's report, outlines. What is grabbing your attention or raising the greatest alarm bells for you?
Well, I guess my alarm bells have been ringing for some time, to be frank with you. But in this report, I think the points that are being made that that the warnings of the past have simply just not been listened to, or they've been listened to but not heard, as the director of UNEP stated at the opening of this program, and that now is the time that we have to act. We can make a huge difference in the coming decades as to what will happen. But there are some things, and this is new for IPCC to say, there are some things that will be with us for essentially, beyond anything we can imagine, hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, like sea level rise, it will take 10,000 years to rebuild the glaciers and the lost ice from Antarctica and Greenland. And the acidity of the ocean will be with us forever, perhaps. So we have done serious damage, but we can mitigate some of that damage for other things like the temperature. We can manage the temperature and get things back to a livable situation.
Okay, so Professor Law, let me turn back to you, because digging a little bit deeper into the various observations that William Mumaw there is making, it seems that one of the big takeaways from today's report is that even if humanity were to drastically cut carbon emissions today, right now, this second, on August 9th, 2021. The report says that even in that absolute best case scenario, we could see a total warming rise of about 1.5 degrees C in the next couple of decades. What are the implications of that?
Well, there are grand implications for, that's a global average, but it's going to vary regionally. And that's one of the great things about this report is that it has a little more regional specificity on which areas are going to get hit hard. And some of that we're seeing right now. So it's not only the natural systems, the forests and the marine systems, it's all of the biodiversity, the wildlife, animals, fish, birds, everything's going to be impacted, not just humans. And of course, whatever impacts them trickles down to us.
But so if I could just add, so to be clear, it seems though that that hotter future is essentially guaranteed now. That's what the report is saying. Am I reading that right?
Yeah, it looks like at least 1.5°C, and that's, we're hoping to keep it there. So one of the things that that has bothered us and that's been hard to get a grasp of is the extreme events. Mm-hmm. And we've had some recent hot extremes over the past decade. And as they stated, it's that would have been extremely unlikely to occur without human influence on climate change. And so these record-shattering heat waves are occurring three times more often than they did in the 1960s. We've lived long enough to have experienced what this is like. And now we're trying to figure out how to grapple with the extremes. Again, they're pretty hard to predict over the long term, but the people who are predicting weather had a really good handle on this with their modeling, the near-term modeling.
Mm-hmm. William Mua, again, I'm struck how that 1.5 degrees to Professor Law's point, first of all, it is a global average, right? Which tends to obscure the extremes, right? It's like talking about median income in the United States and not acknowledging that we have multi-billionaires and people who are living on pennies a day. So can you add to what Professor Law is saying about even in that best case scenario, what that would mean in terms of sort of regional or extreme events? Any examples that you want to point to that are going on right now that we haven't already thought about a lot, like, the Western drought in the United States? Any other global examples you think are illustrative?
I think that's a great analogy about how averages can hide what everyone is experiencing. The Earth is not heating uniformly, and the Arctic is warming vastly faster than the rest of the Earth, and that is changing the dynamics of the atmospheric weather patterns. And for example, in the past, a month or so ago, Professor Law in Oregon was nearby Portland was at 116 degrees, unprecedented. Meanwhile, I here in New England was experiencing a summer day of 73 degrees. I mean, that's the regional disparity that we're seeing just within the United States. And so one of the aspects of this report is it uses longer-term averages. So it says, okay, over the past two decades, the average temperature has risen by 0.99 degrees Celsius, which is roughly a couple of degrees Fahrenheit. And in fact, last year, the rise above pre-industrial levels was about 1.2 degrees. So we're talking about 1.5 degrees by focusing on the longer term trends, which is understandable because there's a lot of fluctuation going on, and not mentioning the more recent changes. People may have the sense that we have more time. We can take more time to do this, when in fact, what we're doing is those past decades are like We were driving along the fine interstate highway, and only in the last 100 yards do we see that it's going off a cliff. But we're not looking at the last 100 yards. And that's what we're facing, is the last 100 yards right now. And that's showing that these trends are accelerating. And the IPCC has been warning about this for years, and it's fallen on deaf ears. And we could talk about why that is the case and the role that governments have played in doing so.
I want to do that a little bit later in the show. But Professor Law, let me turn back to you here, because while it is true that we can talk in the abstract about these numbers and what the data say, the way human beings work, nothing is as powerful a demonstrator of or a convincer of the fact that the climate is changing than personal firsthand experience. And I will fully admit, I'm actually broadcasting from probably a few blocks away from you. I'm in Corvallis, Oregon right now, because this is the town where I grew up. And I'm also a proud OSU grad, so go Beavers. But for the past 20 years, I've been living in New England. I'm just happened to be back here in Oregon visiting. So it's been a while since I've been here. And walking around the forests now, I was over by Black Butte in Central Oregon a couple of weeks ago, and just even here on the more Pacific side of things, I have never felt it as dry underfoot or even in my hands as I'm feeling it now. I mean, you can hear the bone dry forest floor crunch underneath every single footstep you take. And it's not where we are right now. The fires aren't even burning. So, I mean, it's that visceral how much things have changed here. You must feel that too.
Oh, yes, absolutely. The fires ran through my research site that I've been running for 20 years. It was a normal kind of mixed regime fire, but we've experienced that, and it's just, it's oppressive. When we went outside, it looked like we were on Mars.
Yeah. Professor Law, stand by for a second, because I want to hear more about that when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we are talking about the International Panel on Climate Change's latest report released just today. It's the UN's international group of scientific experts representing more than 190 countries. This is their sixth report on how the climate is changing on planet Earth. And the UN Secretary General calls this one a code red moment for humanity. I'm joined today by William Mumai. He's Professor Emeritus of International Environmental Policy at Tufts University, lead author of 5 earlier IPCC reports. Beverly Law also joins us as well, Professor Emeritus at Oregon State University's Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society, and a previous reviewer for earlier IPCC reports. And Professor Law, I'm a big believer in gritty and granular examples. So can you tell us a little bit more? We were talking about how the forests of the Pacific Northwest have been changing. And really, like, I just can't get over, like, I can snap branches off trees and they practically fall apart in your hands. They're so dry. So tell us more about how even your research sites have changed. You said it looked like Mars recently.
Yeah, the fires last year burned through Green Ridge area. It's in Ponderosa Pine in the dry side of Oregon. And as we've always been saying, the dry systems are just going to get drier. Well, it's definitely happening there. I mean, if you breathe in, you just felt the dryness in your mouth. And I used to say I could feel vapor pressure deficit. That's a combination of temperature and humidity. Just by opening my mouth and breathing in, total dryness. It's like the opposite of when you go out in freezing cold weather. And so a fire ripped through our site, and We've managed to avoid having this happen, but it is in a natural recreation area too. So it's difficult to keep people out of the burn, out of those areas when the risk is so high. But I went back through the site after it had burned with a TV crew and also walked the surface after the post-fire logging. And it was a moonscape, just the bare soil. It puffs up when you step on it. It's so dry. And there's nothing left, no shrubs, nothing. So that's not because of the fire, though. It might have recovered on its own, but it was heavily managed. So that's what we were experiencing at these sites, and we've been tracking the responses to climate and interannual variation in weather conditions and how the ecosystems have responded. Ponderosa pine does relatively well. It's very, very resilient species. But more recently, we had this a very dry event, and we're going to have it again this week, over 100 degrees, mm-hmm. about 103 to 106. And it dried. I was getting reports from people around the area, the west side, which is wetter area. And it was these shade-tolerant trees, like the western hemlock and western red cedar, that had their needles just dry up. And it, mm-hmm. so that meant they hit their thermal limit. They couldn't take it. And those needles will fall. It doesn't mean the trees will die, but it's the first we've seen of this.
Honestly, that what you're describing, that this is the place I grew up. And what you're describing, what I'm seeing, I've never seen before in my entire life. It is definitely different. And folks, wherever you are listening to this right now, hop on Twitter or Facebook. We're at On Point Radio. And let us know how you've seen the environment, the climate change, the indicators that you look to see how the world around you has changed, where you grew up or where you live now. Would love to hear from other folks about their visual or tactile evidence of climate change in their localities. So we're on Twitter, Facebook, at On Point Radio. Professor Mumma, let me turn back to you here, because obviously we're talking about the entire world. And in sort of preparing for this conversation today, I stumbled upon something that you had pointed out to our producers about the Amazon, that parts of the Amazon rainforest are already turning into savanna. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yes, it's a very disconcerting report that came out just in the last 2 months, that there are significant parts of the Amazon that have gone from being a sink for carbon dioxide, meaning they absorb more carbon dioxide than they release, those areas are becoming savanna-like. And if this continues, the forest will become a savanna, which means that it will probably not be possible to recover as a tropical rainforest. That's an astounding transformation. As you probably know, the Southeast, there are three basic tropical forests. The Southeast Asian ones have been pretty much decimated for palm oil plantations and logging. The Amazon is being cut up with a patchwork of cuts, and the only remaining tropical forest that is still absorbing about a billion tons of carbon more than it's emitting is the Congo. The Amazon is not the only forest that has had a dramatic change. About a little over a month ago, it was announced in Canada that the managed forests of Canada have gone from being a net sink for carbon dioxide to becoming a net source of carbon dioxide. And that's almost entirely due to harvesting practices. In the Amazon, it's mostly clearing.
Wait, can I just stop,
agriculture.
Professor Mumma? Can I stop you there? Because you were talking about the managed forests of Canada becoming a carbon producer now because of how the Canadians have decided. When we say manage, you mean like what they're harvesting versus what they're preserving?
That's correct. The IPCC rules are that a country gets to decide which of its forests are managed and which are unmanaged. And strangely enough, the only ones that have to be reported are for their managed forests. And the Canadians and other countries, you know, there have been a lot of these spontaneous fires up in the Arctic. And so Russia and Canada and the United States, for that matter, with Alaska, prefer not to have those fires count against them. The atmosphere counts them, but for compliance purposes, they don't count. So these are just the forests that are managed, which means that they are, and the argument is always, well, they're managed sustainably, which means we don't cut more than we'll grow back. Well, if that were true, that would keep the amount of carbon in the forest constant. It would neither be adding more nor removing more than it was the year before. But it's clear the Canadians have shot well beyond that, you know, on the over-harvesting side. And so our wonderful temperate forests are being converted into other kinds of landscapes as well.
And did I hear you correctly a little earlier when you said that the only tropical forest left that is a net sink for carbon is in Congo now?
That's the finding that's been reported. Yes,
that is stunning. I mean, what are the implications of that?
Not good. the implications are that one of the things the report does do is it points out that remarkably, for the past 60 years, the natural sinks, forests, wetlands, grasslands, and so on, have been removing a constant percentage have kept up with the growth in carbon dioxide along with the oceans. So the land-based plants and the oceans have been removing about 56%, an amount equal to 56% of what we emit every year from all actions, including deforestation and fossil fuels and cement making and everything else. And that's pretty remarkable because it means that that they have continued to grow, and that's because of carbon dioxide fertilization and the capacity of the ocean to keep absorbing carbon. That is important. There is no technology that we can imagine that can be removing 56% of what we emit today.
Right.
And yet. The report then went on to say, but this might not keep up forever. Well, that's true, but they don't say why. And the why is twofold. One is, of course, the damage to forests from the drying and the heating that you've been talking about. And the other is the increased over-harvesting, not just for wood products, but for bioenergy. Mm. In Europe, they're burning it to make electricity so that they don't have to burn coal. But it's more carbon intensive than coal for the amount of electricity you get. And there are loopholes in the accounting system that allow them to do that.
Right. Well, Professor Mumma and Professor Law, stand by here for just a second, because this is truly, obviously, we're talking about global climate change here. And the examples that we're hearing both close to home and abroad are more chilling than ever. For example, we just got a tweet from an On Point listener who says, here in Vermont, we are seeing smoky skies, record drought, invasive species, and climate refugees starting to come. Just the beginning. It's a terrifying time to be a parent. Hard to see hope when I feel I've been screaming into the wind for 12 plus years. Again, listeners, let us know what you're seeing regarding changing climate where you are. We're at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, let's go to Europe, since you mentioned Europe, Professor Mouma, and specifically to Greece. Alexi Papahelas joins us now from the Greek island of Kea. Alexi is executive editor of the Greek daily newspaper Kathimerini. Welcome to On Point, Alexi.
Yeah, nice to be with you, Megan.
So obviously, Greece has been in the grip of historic fires there. Can you just describe a little bit of what the nation has been experiencing? Today, we're seeing images of people on a particular Greek island being evacuated by ferry, while in the distance, as they move away from the island, the whole island seems to be burning. So what has been going on?
We went through a devastating experience. First, there was a fire in Athens, in the biggest park we have in Athens, historic park, actually, which is completely burnt down. And then there was this fire on this island, which is the second biggest island that we have here in Greece. It seems that about one-third of it has been burned so far. People had to be evacuated by boats from different resort towns and so on. And we're not sure how many people have lost their homes. We estimate it's about 1,000 to 1,500 people who have lost their homes. It's a pretty bad situation. I mean, the whole sky around Athens was very smoky, was very smelly, you know, for like 4 or 5 days. People couldn't really, you know, go out in the streets. Older people had to be very careful and stay indoors. It's still a very challenging kind of situation.
And international fire crews are coming to Greece to help. That's how large the scale of the fires are. Is that right?
Yeah, the problem is that everybody's facing the same kind of challenge around it. I mean, Italy has some huge fires. Turkey experienced some tremendous fires last week. So everybody's kind of reluctant to share their, their capabilities because their resources. But still, there is a lot of flowing in from different countries around Europe. And I think Europe is about to decide that we have to invest in a civil protection kind of force that will be, you know, pan-European for every European country. It's something we don't have so far, and something that I think that the European leaders are about to decide to go ahead with.
Wait, so sorry, your line's a little rough to hear. So can you repeat that, Alexi, that Europe is about to decide to have some kind of pan-European firefighting force? Say that again.
Yes, I mean, the idea is to have like a fleet, for example, of firefighting planes, because it's just too expensive for, you know, countries like Greece to maintain their own for just a moment of crisis. So the idea is, you know, to pull together our resources and to create like a common, firefighting fleet that will be used in any country around Europe, especially in the south, because it's mainly the south of Europe that has been facing the challenge.
I see. And so, of course, what underlies that is the belief and the reality that there is going to be an ongoing necessity for a pan-European firefighting force, right?
Oh, yeah. This is becoming, it's almost like a yearly phenomenon now. In Italy, in Turkey, in Greece, in Spain. You also had the floods, as you know, in Germany. So I think climate change is very real. It's a real challenge for us. And I think Europe is waking up to that reality.
Okay, so tell me how different is these like now annual fires you're saying in Southern Europe, especially from when you were growing up, Alexi?
Well, I mean the heat waves are becoming almost like a permanent fixture. We had a story the other day that Athens had the highest temperature since 1858, I think, and it's becoming a reality. I mean, you know, the weather is much hotter. The forests are like really, really dry, and this is becoming a real problem. And the fires are, you know, almost like, like every summer we have a big fire, at least one big fire.
Huh. Well, Alexi Papahelas is joining us from the Greek island of Kea. He's executive editor of the Greek daily newspaper, Kathimerini. Alexi, thank you so very much, and please, I hope you stay safe.
Thank you. My pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Beverly Law, we have about a minute here before we have to take our next break here. Respond to what you heard Alexi saying, that there's just yet another example of how, you know, in entire new systems now, He's talking about the emergence of a pan-European wildfire fighting service now, that these new systems have to be created to cope with not just our climate future, but our climate present.
Yes. As you know, in the U.S., we have a pretty good firefighting. It's almost like a military system with the planes and so well coordinated. And now Europe is developing theirs, and other countries might need to also. Something else that I was thinking about, though, is that one of the things, in spite of these things that are happening, is we need to propose establishment of strategic climate and biodiversity reserves for carbon storage and accumulation and protect biodiversity.
Mm. So when we come back, we're going to talk about more about what we can do. We've been ringing the alarm bell a lot this hour. We will move towards solutions. And we're getting a lot of comments online here. John McKay says, I live now in Connecticut, but I grew up on a farm in northern Alberta. The recent droughts have been unprecedented, and the municipal district there recently declared an agricultural disaster. And Midas Torin says, what this tells us is capitalism has killed us all for profit. There is nothing stopping collapse now. We'll talk about that later. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and just want to give you a preview about what we're going to be talking about later this week, our series about Amazon, the company. Our series called The Prime Effect is going to continue on Wednesday, and we're going to be talking about Amazon and surveillance, not just digital, but physical surveillance as well, because here's a company that not only has a lot of your consumer behavior at its disposal, but it's also in your neighborhoods in terms of a Ring doorbell or, say, all those Amazon trucks with cameras on them. So do you have a Ring doorbell? Or do you even have an Amazon Echo or Dot in your home? Do you worry about how your data from those devices is being used or could be used? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. We'll love to feature your stories in our next episode of Amazon, The Prime Effect. We'll be talking about surveillance. Today, we are talking about the latest report from the International Panel on Climate Change, the UN's scientific advisory panel that represents more than 190 nations. This is their sixth major climate report they've released. And the UN Secretary General calls it a code red moment for humanity. And we're getting a lot of input here from On Point listeners in terms of things that they are seeing regarding climate change where they live. Dan Hersher says mostly torrential rain in northern Wisconsin, much warmer winters. Gail White says from Dubuque, Iowa, high heat, very little rain, but my scariest observation, no bugs. I understand no mosquitoes due to dry conditions, but gnats normally are a constant presence. Not this year. Let's see what else we got. We have here. We've got something. Oh, Wayne Simmons says, as a kid who grew up on the coast of Maine in the 70s and 80s, I didn't have to give ticks and their pathogens a second thought. Nowhere near the case now. D. Campbell says, when I was a kid in the early 70s, we had ice skating parties on our family lake in Virginia. Now the lake doesn't freeze enough to skate on. So just a little bit of a taste here from things that people are seeing where they live. I'm joined today by William Mumma and Beverly Law. They've both been involved in previous reports from the IPCC. And William Mumma, before we talk about what we can do. There's a couple more questions regarding this specific report that I want to explore with both you and Professor Law. And first of all, we have been talking about sort of the best case future scenario and what seems to be already locked in into our climate future, even if we got to net zero carbon emissions today. But there's also the scenario on if we don't actually achieve major reductions in carbon. They're talking about a 3 or 4 degree global average temperature rise over the next, you know, many decades. And how much closer does that bring us to what's kind of being called now irrevocable climate tipping points? Or are we already there?
Well, the tipping points are when the system begins to change to the point that that the changes accelerate more changes. So there are these reinforcing feedbacks. Just a couple of quick examples. You know, the melting of the Arctic sea ice means there's less light reflected, sunlight reflected, and so it's warming much faster. And that then warms the Arctic more, which then causes the permafrost to thaw and for there to dry out and be more forest fires in the boreal regions and so on. And if that cycle gets out of control in the sense that it can't be turned around, even if we lowered the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that would be catastrophic. But fortunately, a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the weather changes can be changed by lowering the temperature of the Earth back towards what it used to be. And that can only be done by reducing the amount of heat-trapping gases in the atmosphere. And so, you know, I mean, this all sounds like gloom and doom, but for me, the hope is knowing that there are things that we can do that will turn this around. We can't slow down sea level rise, but we can slow down these weather events, these terrible weather events, including these incredible droughts, if we could lower the temperature. And so to do that, we need to obviously, as rapidly as possible, reduce our emissions. So run out as fast as you can, get those solar panels, get your electric vehicle. Make your house better insulated. Make sure that your place of work is doing what it can to reduce its emissions. And let's make that energy transition as rapidly as possible. But at the same time, we have to increase the rate at which carbon dioxide is removed from the atmosphere. And that can be done by a combination of letting more existing forests grow. Beverly Law pointed out the need for these strategic forest reserves. The same is true with our grasslands, the way they're managed, with our agriculture, the way it's practiced, and the protection. You know, people don't think much of wetlands as anything but wastelands, but they have been hugely important in the amount of carbon that they store, and yet we degrade them and release that carbon dioxide almost instantly. So taking a look at what we can do in the natural world and what we can do in terms of reducing our emissions from the way we live our lives have to go hand in hand, and they have to be – all those efforts need to be accelerated immediately.
Yeah. You know, we've been focusing a lot on forests so far this hour, but obviously there's no ecosystem that's untouched by climate change. And Jeremy Fugarino send us this message saying, I want to hear more about sea temperature changes. And also, Jeremy's curious about how sea currents are handling the influx of fresh water dispersed into the oceans, which would probably become an even more extreme issue if we see the continuing rate of acceleration of melting in both Greenland and the Antarctic. So Beverly Law, do you want to provide some insight about effects on sea temperatures?
Well, I guess one thing I'm actually thinking about is the most recent article about the Gulf Stream that flows north from the warm waters up to, say, Scotland. And it's what keeps Scotland balmy. Otherwise, it would be quite a frigid place for its latitude. And so there's more evidence of it now. And I think that what was concerning is they're expecting that there might be this kind of collapse of it sooner than expected. I think it would be 300 years before, and now we're talking about sooner than that. So that's worrisome because, as you know, with the oceans and atmosphere, when you have big circulations changing, they can do big things all around the world. You can have effects in North America from that, as well as Scotland and other locations.
Hmm. You know, I think one thing I've been thinking about a lot, not just over the course of this hour, but in the weekend in anticipation of this morning's report coming out, is the fact that now the first one was put out in 1990. So here we are 31 years later. Not only do we have the observable reality of how much has changed in those 30 years, so what science can actually measure and then therefore model, but we can now check the accuracy of the reports, of the first reports from the IPCC, right? So I was looking back at the 1990 report, William Mumaw, and it says that sort of the do-nothing option, or if the world sort of the business-as-usual scenario, it called it then in 1990, if the world sort of continued on, they predicted in 1990 we would see an average increase in global temperature of about 1 degree centigrade above what was present in 1990, and that we would see that by 2025. So first of all, how, looking back now, how accurate was that 1990 report?
It was ridiculously accurate, given the information we had at the time. I was not on that first report, but I did attend the very first meeting of the IPCC in 1988 when it was formed. The meeting was in Washington, D.C., and I was working there at the time. That's when I began my work on climate change as the first director of the climate program at the World Resources Institute. And it's interesting that all throughout, beginning in the 1970s, there were many scientists who pointed out that climate change was happening, that it was going to happen. And I was also at the hearing, on the hearing panel with Jim Hansen in 1988 when he made his famous statement that climate change is already here. And everybody said, hey, what are you talking about? It's just a hot day in Washington. But there was enough information, even if we didn't have the massive observations we have today, to understand that this was happening and it was going to get worse. And every single report has more and more certainty. I mean, it starts off with, it is possible that, and then it becomes, it's at least as likely as not. And then it becomes, somewhat certain to, it's over. I mean, it's absolutely certain. That's what this last report says. So there's been an evolution of this cautious approach that's been taken all along in the scientific community, where very few, except the very brave, have been willing to go out in front and say, it's here, it's now, it's getting worse, it's going to be worse still, and it could become catastrophic if we don't do something.
I mean, when you look back at the 1990 report, the cautious language is noted, right? Because they talk about not being able to fully predict what exact weather patterns would be due to the variability of weather, et cetera. So point well taken. That's always a challenge in science. But even yes, buried within those sort of caveats are statements like this. With a modest increase in the mean global temperature, the number of days with temperatures above a given value at the high end of the distribution will increase substantially. There will also be a decrease in the days of temperature at the low end of the distribution. So a decrease in cooler days, a substantial increase in hotter days, okay? The number of very hot days or frosty nights will be substantially changed without any change in the variability of the weather. So essentially setting what the new normal would be. That was in 1990. I mean, Beverly Law, Is it fair to say that we are living in the world now that was predicted by the 1990 IPCC report?
Yes, as Bill says, it's just the certainty has improved. And so, those brave people that spoke out first, like Dave Keeling, who was measuring atmospheric CO2 from the top of Mauna Loa and said, we have a problem. We've known it. It's just they're more certain. And that's how science works. You keep working on reducing the uncertainty to make sure you're correct.
Okay. You know, Bill Mumma calls, you've said this, Bill, that this is our, it's like the Paul Revere moment, right? That the people have been crying that the British are coming, and but now they are here. So do you think that nations are more likely to actually act now than they were in 1990?
I think they are, but... But governments have been the problem with IPCC reports all along. As you know, the scientists put together the report, and then they write this summary for policymakers. And then that has to be approved by governments. And so governments sit there and nitpick the language and take things out. And in fact, at the 1.5-degree report meeting, the one that just occurred for this report, Saudi Arabia tried to basically throw the whole thing off the track, and they had to drop any mention of the nationally determined contributions, which is the diplomatic way of saying this is what we say we will do. Whether we'll do it or not, it's another matter, because they just didn't want to have to admit that the oil era has to end. So I think that one of the biggest problems we have is that you have to have absolute universal agreement by governments for the IPCC report to be approved, for any action to be taken concerted action taken at the UN. Just look at the problem we have in the United States between states that are coal and oil producers and those that are not. Right. I mean, in Massachusetts, it's no big deal to say we're going to not have any more natural gas hookups. Try doing that in Texas. So these special interests are able to dominate the system, both here and in Europe. I've been involved in advising the European Commission. And, ironically, on the day that the big floods occurred, or the Monday after the big floods occurred in Germany, they made an announcement of what their forest strategy was going to be, which if they had more forest, the floods wouldn't be as bad. And yet they totally failed to make the connection. So governments are a huge problem. And this is why it is so encouraging to see that individuals, institutions, and even many corporations are picking up the ball and running with it and getting way ahead of everybody else, of the governments.
Well, Professor Law, on that note, we've just got about 45 seconds left. I'm so sorry, we're running out of time here. But William Mumma's point about governments being a challenge to finding solutions is well taken, but people still want to know what they can do, even as individuals. What thoughts would you like to leave them with?
Individuals, as Bill said, improve the energy efficiency of your home, have smaller homes, plant-based diet, natural climate solutions. We need to protect these systems that are doing the job of taking carbon out of the atmosphere, forests, as well as marine systems. And we basically need to adapt to more frequent fires.
And how about pressuring those very governments that represent them as well?
Yes, they're definitely going to have to do that.
Well, Beverly Law, Professor Emeritus at Oregon State University's Department of Forest Ecosystems and Society and a reviewer for three past IPCC reports, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Bill Mumma, Professor Emeritus of International Environmental Policy at Tufts University and lead author of earlier IPCC reports. Professor Mumma, thank you as well.
Thank you for having me, Meghna. Appreciate it.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.